My people, the night is beautiful, so the faces of my people. The stars are beautiful, so the eyes of my people. Beautiful also is the sun, beautiful also are the souls of my people. Profiles with Wendell Pierce.
What do you want people to know about Katori Hall?
Ooh. Is she regular degla? Yeah. And she just a girl with big ears and that I listen and I not only do I hear, but I listen.
Yes, she does. Hello and welcome to Profiles with Wendell Pierce. I'm your guest host, LaTanya Norton. And today we sit down with Katori Hall, a Pulitzer Prize and award-winning playwright and the creator, producer of the critically acclaimed, record-breaking television series, P-Valley. Season 2 airs on Starz. Today, Hall shares how it all started for the curious girl from Memphis and her journey to becoming a world-renowned storyteller.
You know, I haven't gotten to this point in my life where I am seeing a lot of success in regards to my storytelling, you know, from P-Valley to, you know, which is a TV show, to my plays. It's been, you know, Sometimes I'm like, I gotta pinch myself because, you know, as an aspiring writer, you hope that one day you'll win a Pulitzer. You hope that you'll have a hit TV show, mm-hmm. but obviously none of that is guaranteed. So for me, I think I've always been led by this very deep passion and fuel to just represent my people. And I think it kind of mm-hmm. extends from growing up in Memphis with, you know, two amazing parents who sacrificed a lot for me. And I owe so much to Cabe and LaSalle. Shout out, Mama Dad.
Yes.
Who really just taught me that it was okay to be geeky, it was okay to be nerdy and to, you know, fall into books for hours and hours on end. I do think like the earliest telltale sign that I was going to be a storyteller was that I could sit by myself against the wall with my dollhouse for hours and hours and hours and hours on end. Like I really didn't need a babysitter. Like I would just make up stories. Story, and I'm not being hyperbolic at all. So in a weird way, those kind of innocent moments, those are definitely the bricks of my storytelling journey, having mm-hmm, parents mm-hmm. that are natural storytellers themselves and who, like I said, really, really supported me along the way. But, you know, the journey has been long and filled with a lot of failure.
But you fell forward, right?
It's interesting. I think when you're failing, you don't think that you're failing forward. You just think that you're failing. you think that mm-hmm. you're never going to, quote unquote, make it. You're never going to get a good review or whatnot. But, you know, I would say my love affair with drama, you know, because dramatic writing is because I failed at acting. You know, wow. I used to want to be an actress, you know, and what was so interesting was that the main reason why I became a writer that focused on drama was because I wanted to create these stories and these opportunities for women who looked like me. But in real time, just for my friends, I was like, let me give my friends some jobs. Let me, if I can't give myself no job, I'm going to give my friends some jobs.
Look out for my people, right?
Constantly looking out for the people. So right. That was kind of, you know, this thing of going on audition after audition and never really getting booked that much that made me really kind of hunker down on at the keyboard, so to speak. So mm-hmm. yeah, this journey's been like, you know, super winding, filled with a lot of failure. Even like my first plays, I remember them not being, totally well reviewed. I actually think it's good to kind of get that whole that moment of you good, but not yet.
It hurts though.
And I think for a Black writer, especially when you're writing in an industry where there's not many of you, and they're coming from, or whether they're used to lauding perspectives that are very white male centric, like you feel as though whatever you have to offer will never kind of break through. It will never kind of be as important. That, at least that's the message that they give you, even though you know if you think part of hearts otherwise. But yeah, you deal with the, as we say, the slangs and arrows, and it does hurt, but it's that thing of getting scars and those scars building into something that looks a lot like strength.
How would you define yourself? Who is Katori Hall?
Ooh, child. Who is Katori Hall? I'm definitely this person that I think, I joke with my friends all the time. There's the idea of me, and then there is the me. And what's beautiful is that I think the older you get, the more comfortable you are with yourself, those two things begin to align more. And I feel as though from the distance, the idea of me can, it may feel like, oh, she's just completely, focused on, rising to the top. She's, super ambitious. Obviously she's, she's very smart. But I feel like now that there is space for me to be wider in the world, the Katori Hall that I want people to know is like the Katori Hall that's a mother, the Katori Hall that actually is kind of shy and really rather be at home than out in these streets. like super fun loving, just very, very family oriented. I don't really like the sparkle and the shine that I think, particularly with this whole P-Valley situation, has been happening. I love being a writer. I love being in the background. And I think it's because I just really love hiding in plain sight, as most writers, I think, love to do, where you can have all these amazing conversations with people and people are super, super open with you. I think that has a lot to do with the fact that I am so curious about the world, curious about people. I started out as a journalist before I dipped my toes into the acting pond. I thought I was going to, be a person who was more of a chronicler and ask people questions and demanded answers from the world. I even started writing for my hometown newspaper, the Commercial Appeal, in Memphis, when I was like 14, 15 years old. So this quest to question and and to, define the world through research is something that's always kind of been in my DNA. And so it's definitely a natural, I would say, reflection of who I am as a human being, as a person. What other sides of Katori Hall, like I'm a wife, but at my core, I do think that I'm definitely, definitely a sensitive artist. And I feel as though in terms of my purpose, I'm definitely fulfilling it. I feel like no matter if it's journalism, no matter if it's, the acting, directing, like you're saying, all these kind of titles, all of those kind of exist under this umbrella term of storyteller.
Yes.
And so, in the best of ways, I think that is the thing that has defined me the most, even in my personal life. Like I still continue, even when I'm not quote unquote working, I feel as though I'm walking through my own movie of my own life. And I chalk up every day as a scene or a chapter.
Yeah.
That's just kind of how my brain naturally thinks. Like I can't get away from thinking about life as story. And so because God has kind of made me that way, I think, you know, when you think of Katori Hall, you think of a story whore, as I like to a huge collector and lover of story.
Of stories, because everyone has one, right? And so many don't get told. So I can definitely relate to you on that. So what was it like growing up in Memphis?
So I had a very interesting childhood. And I actually think that a lot of Black folks probably can relate to this childhood, this thing of like, you got these two parents, right? Hardworking folk, you know, and they want everything for you that they did not have the opportunity to have. And so the sacrifice begins young. So, you know, we were living in this area in Memphis called Orange Mound. And, you know, my dad was from an area called Klondike. And then my mom was from like downtown Memphis. So, you know, they were like, you know, working class, you know, lower class people in terms of the economic class that they were existing and living in. So they pulled their little money together. They put their coins together and they're like, okay, we gonna move to the burbs.
because moving on up, right?
Oh yes, that journey, I would say traditional African American journey of like, okay, we started from the bottom, now we're here. So we ended up integrating this neighborhood and this street in this neighborhood called Raleigh. And we were one of three Black families that moved in at the time. And, you know, as a young kid, so this was what, how old was I? Ooh, I was like four when this happened.
Okay.
And so, you know, you get there and yes, you the world looks different, it feels different, it smells different, but you are kind of like protected and, you know, shored up by family. But when you start going to school, you start seeing and feeling that difference of being the only one, which in mentally, you're like, oh, something is different, but it's almost like a soul impact because you kind of come into this collision of, can I be my truest self? Even at a young age, can I be my true self, my Black self in this space? And luckily, because my parents just refused to pull themselves completely from their roots. So while I was at school, you know, Monday through Friday, you know, with the mostly white kids at that time. Now I'm just saying at that time, because as I finish my story, you'll see that there was a shift as that happens a lot, you know, down south. So, you know, like I said, Monday through Friday was at the school. And then on the weekends, we was at Big Mama's house. And so this thing, you learn how to be bicultural. You learn how to do the code switching. And so you get the training, you get the years of, you know, walking this tightrope of at least, you know, cultural and racial identity, particularly in the American South. Now, what was so interesting about us kind of being those first three Black families, one of the three Black families that kind of integrate this area, was that it triggered this shift of white flight. So very simply, we, you know, with our eyes could see this transformation happening in our neighborhood. It ain't bothered me though. Like, you know, the shift of, you know, things getting more sepia toned. And and so in a weird way where you started out in a place of like discomfort, but, you know, as more and more Black families moved in, there was just this kind of I just feel like Black folks gonna build community wherever they are. And I felt that, you know, that street, as it got blacker and blacker, we became this kind of big family, so to speak, that depend on one another in hard times. So also what was interesting about my school was that, like a lot of Southern schools, they did this thing called tracking where, you know, they divided each grade into quote unquote, not classes, it wasn't necessarily divisions, but I'll just say, different tracks. And so you notice that at the top track where there was more access to like AP classes, I was one of three Black students in these like AP classes. I was always called the blackest one. Like they had three, yes, meaning I was the one who was the most closely connected to, you know, my quote unquote community, Black folks, whereas the other, you know, young women were seen as like quote unquote Oreos. You know,
oh, okay.
Outside, white on the inside, but it's like, oh, but Katori, she cool.
Uh-huh.
I think it had a lot to do with that constantly growing up, walking a line. But also
because you were Black inside and outside.
Exactly.
Right.
In real talk, those young women were too. It's just that there's these certain identifiers, the way that you speak, the way that you speak, et cetera, et cetera, that other people try to kind of distinguish you from or separate you from your Blackness. So that being said, I was always, you know, that type, that young woman who really was friends with every track. Like I was just, and I think that has a lot to do with the fact that I'm just extremely curious about the world and curious about people.
Yeah.
It feels like a natural progression that I've ended up where I've ended. And so, yes, this interesting childhood growing up in Memphis where, I'm constantly kind of poking holes through these racial constructs, you know, socioeconomical constructs, and there being a kind of natural fluidity to my own identity really allowed me to, I would say, have this intense amount of comfort in my own skin that I think is kind of my claim to fame, this coat that I wear, even till today.
Do you recall any instances where you experienced overt racism?
Oh, absolutely. I remember we were playing in the front yard and I was like, is this a scene out of Mississippi Burning? Like, what the hell is this? Like, there was these, you know, white dudes in a white pickup truck that had a Confederate flag on the back and they were coming down a really busy street. We lived on a very busy street called Yale Road. And I remember them like throwing a bottle and it hitting the sidewalk. And we instantly knew what that was. Like, this is the most extreme version of racism that, you know, a young Black child growing up in Memphis in the 80s and the 90s, late 80s and 90s can have. And then there's the subtle stuff where, you know, I ended up getting a lot of scholarships to go to college. And, you know, I remember a white classmate saying, you know, the only reason why you got those scholarships is because you're Black. And I'm like, because I'm Black? Or, you know, despite, what you really saying? You know?
It wasn't based on your merit.
It wasn't based on my merit. It was based off of this, as if I didn't deserve
affirmative action.
It was like totally, affirmative action. And so it's those, you can say it's a microaggression, but I kind of felt like that was aggressive. But it was a huge spectrum of that very insidious, you know, pervasive, stubborn, thing that I think every Black person probably deals
with. Yeah.
And it just, it goes to like how much you want to name it, how much you want to, you know, wrestle with it. Luckily, my parents, very vocal. My mom was a union worker. My dad just like, you know, always would get together at the kitchen table. And so I was really able to always kind of decompress about these situations. Like I truly had that support. There was never a kind of like, oh no, that didn't happen. Or think about it another way. Maybe, you know, it was a compliment. And it's like, no. I was always able to turn to, you know, my Black as hell parents and really honest conversations about the obstacles that I would probably always face. Not just in Memphis, but also in New York City, in Boston.
It's everywhere.
It's literally everywhere. And so those conversations, I think, prepared me.
I want to focus a little bit about your mom, because I saw where your mom actually picked cotton at one point in her life. But not only that, your play The Mountaintop was really inspired by your mom. And it was a depiction of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Tell me a little bit more about that.
So, like I said, my mom, you know, grew up poor in downtown Memphis. And so she would have to cross the bridge and pick cotton in the summer. It was almost like working at Mickey D's at the time. Mm-hmm, you have to cross to over there to Arkansas to get enough money for her school clothes. So, and she could never pick them out that she was supposed to pick. Like, she was very slow. And so she would have other older, more seasoned pickers. They would just kind of throw a little cotton in her bag. But like, isn't that crazy? Like my mom, she's about to turn 70 this week. And that woman has picked cotton in her life. Yes, of course, paid for it, but paid, you know, minimally, as we all know. That is just how the systems down south have had a glacial rate of change. And so growing up in downtown Memphis, she was so close to, you know, she had her cheeks pressed up against the glass of history, in that she viewed these amazing historical moments from her porch, you know, having participated in marches with Dr. King, having, you know, seen social unrest, you know, the night before he was killed on April 4th, 1968, she was supposed to go and hear him speak. And so she was 15 years old at the time. I think she was 15 years old. And you know, Big Mama, her mom was like, you can't go down there. You cannot go down there, because we all know that somebody's out to get him. That rumor was spreading like wildfire in the community. And my mom, you know, she decided, okay, I'm going to honor what my mother has told me to do. I'm going to stay in the house. And so she hear the I've been to the mountaintop speech, his last speech. And the next day, as we all know, that unfortunate chapter of history began. And like I said, she was in the midst of watching the nation burn, and they lived around the corner from the Lorraine Motel. And so, you know, fast forward in my life, my mom would tell me this story definitely every, you know, February for Black History Month. But as much as she could, because I think it was just such a deep regret that she had for her life to not have been in the room with this king, this martyr, right? The martyr movement. And I, sitting at her feet, sitting at my grandmother's feet, I just took in all of their tales, whether they felt like tall tales or not. And I allowed them to inspire me and tattoo themselves on my mind and on my heart. And so around the time that Obama was actually beginning to run for the presidency, you know, we were looking back at Dr. King's legacy. And I decided that I wanted to kind of, you know, pose a question to American society, like, how far have we come since Dr. King's murder? Is there still work to do? How close or not are we to the promised land? And so I ended up being inspired by my mother. So I created this fictional character named after her, Kameh, who, comes to the hotel room, motel room room 306 to give him a cup of coffee, this maid. And over the course of that long night, you know, they battle about politics. They battle about all the isms. But, you know, it's a Garden of Gethsemane moment in that Camée reveals herself to be an angel to let him know that he's going to have to leave and go with her to heaven the next day. And so obviously it's that thing of like, did this happen? Did this not happen? I'm like, of course it didn't happen. And yet it is so true. It's one of those fictions that we use to tell the essence of truth. And really hard play to write, because I think that a lot of people wanted the king on the pedestal. They wanted the
king
on the wall. Like, you walk into my big mama's house and there's like three pictures. It was Dr. King, it was Jesus, and maybe it was Kennedy. I was like, why is Kennedy still up here? But anyway, I digress. And so this kind of deconstruction of the martyr and making him more of a man, warts and all, was something that was very controversial to a lot of people, to audience members, to critics. Yeah.
Even so, the King family.
The King,
right? Family,
absolutely. I actually remember.
What was that meeting like when you met with them?
Yes, so I ended up flying down to Atlanta to meet with Bernice, you know, obviously to get a blessing, to get support, because I definitely wanted them to feel as though this wasn't a kind of smearing campaign at all. It was really this artistic attempt to show that all of us have kings inside of us. All of us can be these extraordinary, ordinary human beings that can change the world. And so I remember we were at lunch, it was me and Kenny. We were sitting across from our dear Bernice King, and I must say, she's a hard one to win over. And I did not win her over at all. Mm-hmm. In that, you know, there she had very valid concerns, and she felt that, like, why couldn't it be more of a historical document? I would just say that, you know, she did not completely embrace this warts and all portrayal of her father, to the point where, you know, there was, she denied that he smoked. And obviously there was the denial of any extramarital affairs. And, you know, in that moment, I realized that, oh, he's not a historical figure to her. This is her father.
This is her father, yeah. Yeah, it's personal.
This is personal. And mm-hmm. as a human being, as a daughter herself, I put myself in her shoes. And I was like, you know, what if somebody rolled up on you and just, you know, said, I'm gonna write a play about your daddy, and I'm gonna, you know, put all this dirty laundry. It might be true. It might be, you know, adjacent to the truth. And yet I don't want, you know, people to know my father, the person who created me like that. I really understood the knee-jerk reaction against the piece. However, as an artist, I felt like this is a historical figure, and therefore, in a weird way, yes, he is her father, but yet he is my king, in that the influence and the impact that he has had as man and martyr, I think is worthy of a deconstruction and an investigation that as an artist I have a right to do. So it was a very complicated meeting. There was, like, you know, no yelling, no hard feelings.
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of, a tense, and validly so, rightfully so, exchange. But then, like, inside of me, I understood definitely the heart of the matter for her specifically. So it was a very complicated moment. And it also, I would say, changed me as an artist, because I decided and had already decided, because I think I come from the world of journalism, right? But it became even more so part of just the way that I kind of move, that I have to, when I'm taking on real life figures, be as respectful as I can. But I have to be true.
Yeah.
True. But it means that I have to get the truth even more right when I am a peddler of fiction and lies. Like the fusion of artifice and accuracy has to have a unique balance in work that's based off of real people and real people's lives.
At the end of the day, you have to tell the truth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it has to be the truth. And I recall an interview where you said, you take humanity away when you don't allow people to make mistakes.
Amen. Yes.
You know?
Amen.
And what I have seen in your work has been a common denominator of humanity. Mm-hmm. It's been that common denominator of, as a journalist, you know, because I believe once a journalist, always a journalist.
Yeah.
But speaking the truth, really. Really seeking the truth, and how do I present the truth? And even though there's a lot of things surrounding it, that core value of the truth is still there, and it's still that common denominator.
Absolutely. Yeah. I just feel as though, particularly for Black folks, right, we've been dehumanized for so long that to demand that I be perfect all the time.
Yeah.
You're not allowing me my humanity. You're not allowing me my mediocrity, my mistakes, mm-hmm. my bad days, my tears, all those things that make me just like you. Right?
It's who I am. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And it is a disservice because now people can't relate to you because you're on that pedestal and you are too perfect. It makes you more relatable when we can see flaws. We can see imperfection. How important is vulnerability?
I think particularly for my Black female characters, it's everything. Mm-hmm. It's what I kind of center a lot of my character building on. You know, obviously there's that big myth of the Black superwoman. Where
yes.
We can.
It is a myth.
Hey, it is a myth. We all here to tell y'all, y'all can't put that on us. Like we bend to breaking sometimes, because of our humanity. And yet historically there's been this expectation of us to have so much strength, to be the backbone of movements, to be just walking forward with our heads held high all the time, when sometimes sister girl got to roll her neck a little bit and come for somebody, right.
Like, and that's okay too.
Give me that, right? So yes, this thing of vulnerability, being able to see Black women as soft, as tender, and real talk, worthy of that tenderness as well, and desiring that tenderness, that care, that compassion that oftentimes the world doesn't give us. I think it's really beautiful when, particularly on TV, in all kinds of stories, you can see a Black woman kind of standing in her vulnerability in a powerful way. There is power in vulnerability, right? And I've been so blessed to have so many opportunities in my own work to showcase what I know to be very true of the Black female experience.
And I say, I was just having this conversation just yesterday with someone about vulnerability. Mm-hmm. So many people think it's a weakness. Mm-hmm. It takes so much strength. Yeah. It takes a lot of strength to be vulnerable. Mm-hmm. It's not a weakness, you know? Would you agree?
Totally agree. And it's funny. I think that the reason why I kind of failed as an actor for a minute is because I was afraid of allowing people to see my vulnerability. Like, I don't think you can be a good actor and not have a good relationship with vulnerability. And so I went through a chapter of my life where I just was afraid to allow people to see me, what I thought was as a weakling, when in all actuality, it was just me as a human being. I have since moved past that part of my life where I put too much on my shoulders, or that I care, you know, so much about what people think. I think the older you get, the more you realize that there's a stadium in your head that you have to dismantle, particularly as an artist, right? So that you don't limit yourself, and that you don't, you know, bar the door to freedom and artistic freedom that I think, you know, that kind of constantly creating from a place where you feel as though someone's looking over your shoulder and judging you. That vulnerability is just so necessary to artists and you know, to people who are just, you know, regular walking through the world, so that they can be able to connect with people and have empathy and be moved and be really connected to the world, because the world, it just feels like it's constantly on fire, especially nowadays. It, you know, everyone's like, is it the end of days? Like, it sure does feel like it. But it's always the end of days. I'm sure people in 1968, you know, when Dr. King was shot, felt the same way. There was not monkeypox then, but there was something else that they were dealing with. So yeah, I definitely feel as though vulnerability is just such a necessary ingredient to being a human being.
Our thought-provoking conversation with award-winning playwright, director, and television producer Katori Hall continues as we travel to the Pank for the hit show P-Valley, based on Hall's 2015 play. It's the story of dancers at a strip club in the South who find themselves exposed to universal challenges and struggles. Hall says the show's mega success didn't come without rejection, redirection, and reflection.
So P-Valley for me comes from a place of, once again, being truthful, but being raw and real and ratchet, in that it is okay, once again, for us to exist widely in the world and not have to appear to be perfect for other people's comfort. And so I actually grew up going to strip clubs as a youngin' in Memphis, was sneaking in. And I was always so impressed, enthralled, moved by the spectacle that I would see, because it wasn't a thing about women taking off their clothes. It was a thing about a woman putting on a show and showing what her body could do, the power of her body, the athleticism. And so that image of strength really tattooed itself on my mind. And so I ended up, you know, moving to New York, doing my playwriting thing. And I remember I was taking classes at Crunchy Gym. They had a pole dancing class and I took it. I really got, you know, it was the du jour. It was the way for, you know, people to, you know, get their core together. And I just remember I could not do it for the life of me. It was such hard work. And in that moment, you know, the idea for at least the play version crystallized itself for me, because I was like, oh my goodness, this culture that I kind of took for granted growing up, and like when I would go back home and visit, you know, and like be a kind of participatory observer in, like, I took this culture for granted. Now I'm trying to do this art form that these women have created, you know, created with their bodies on their backs. And I'm realizing the amount of skill that it takes to do this. I was like, there is a bigger story here about women's work, about Black women's work, about Black women's art as well. And the appropriation of that. And so that's kind of the thing that led me to do all these interviews and visit all these different clubs. Like, it was a 6-year long, and real talk, I'm still doing it. I'm still going to, still having conversations with women, right? But, you know, at that
time. Now, how old were you? How old were you when you snuck into your first club? I just have to know.
Oh, you don't keep me in trouble. You know, I had to use ecstasy. So, you know, probably like 16, 17, probably 17, you know.
Okay.
You know, but that's that's too young.
But, okay. You know, I was just making sure you weren't like in elementary school.
No, no, I wasn't. Younger.
Okay.
But teenager, late teens, right? And, you know, it's just something that you did. But I digress. Spent so much time working, or rather researching. And so as I was researching, I was like putting pen to paper, you know, tacking on the computer. And I remember I ended up doing like a little reading at my apartment, and Nico Annan, who plays Uncle Clifford to this day, that's how I met him. A friend of mine had said, oh, I know somebody, he's queer. I really think that he could do this character service. And, you know, from the moment I met Nico, I began to build Uncle Clifford on his skin and on his tongue. So I am very blessed in that I have been able to write to a specific actor's strengths when it has come to the creation and the evolution of Uncle Clifford as a character. But that was like, you know, from 2009 to 2015. So in 2015, we had the play at Mixed Blood Theater in Minneapolis, and it was such a beautiful failure in that I learned very quickly that there was too much going on in this play of mine. It existed beyond the 2.5 hours that had been given to me for a play. It demanded to go on seemingly for years because the characters were just so interesting. To see Miss Mississippi, La Murda, even at the time, like all these characters were just kind of like pressing up against the walls of the play. And so I very quickly pivoted and went out to LA to do this pitch. And what was so interesting is that no one really wanted it.
Everyone
said no, but stars. So I'm
now, and aren't they kicking themselves now? Oh my
God. You know what? I don't know, because we over here, we doing good. Over where we at.
You were picked up for the second season, like just like that.
Immediately, yes. We were picked immediately. Up immediately, because they saw very quickly the impact. And like even this season, season two has been a roller coaster of a ride. Like every weekend we have trended number one on Twitter. Like it is
That's
so
amazing.
Rare for a TV show, particularly a Black TV show, to trend at that level week by week by week.
And why do you think that is?
I think it's because it's true.
It's true. And it's the world that we know nothing about. Mm-hmm. We know very little about.
It's the world and we know nothing about, but I think that we know a lot about, and that these women and the men and the queer folk, right, they're going through the same stuff that we're all going through. And I actually
think, and what I, go ahead.
I think that's why it's resonating so much. It feels as though it's almost like, oh, this is science fiction. These people are alien to me. And then you sit down and you watch Star Trek, and you're like, oh, wait a minute. No, I could be on that spaceship too. And it's that feeling of something that feels foreign and familiar at the same time, because it is familiar in terms of like the emotional journeys that a lot of the characters are going on.
And what I love is the part I read where you said, you know, you look through thousands of tapes and how long it took to, you know, to cast and to find the right characters, and all of that time was absolutely worth it. And you wanted the women you interviewed to say, that's me, that's my life, that's what I went through.
Yep.
And you needed to see vulnerability, because you needed them to be destigmatized, right? And the part that really jumped out at me was, you needed them to be, or you wanted the world to see that they were not just physically naked, but emotionally naked.
Absolutely.
Your work really does bring out the humanity in everyone, and you wanted to honor them.
Yes, because they're worthy of honor. I mean, like I said, to be in the space of a strip club means you are in the space of spectacle. It is show, on 25 degrees. It is the most, it's like you're at Cirque du Soleil. It's circus and sexy. It's just this incredible show. And yet the people who are putting it on, they are made of flesh and bone. They bleed. They break if they fall off of that pole, you know. There's a kind of Shiro-ness that you see. But I think it's even more interesting when you learn that the Shiro is actually a human being that falls and flies just like you. And it's linked very much to just even my approach to Dr. King. Ordinary people who can do extraordinary things. To me, there's literally no difference in the lens that I'm putting on my characters, whether they're, you know, up on a pole or up on a pulpit.
Yeah, yeah. And the very fact that you're human and the very fact that you're here means that you deserve to have your story told as well.
Absolutely. It's connected in the curiosity, the natural curiosity that I wish everybody had about every human being. You know, I always say that I don't think that TV shows, you know, can necessarily change policy or change the law, but I do think it can soften the hearts of policymakers, you know, open the eyes of people so that when they come to a place where they do need to create policy, change policy, a story has, you know, through the beauty of suspension of disbelief, has allowed them to come to a place of empathy and understanding for people who don't necessarily look and walk and live like them. Like, it's beautiful to see how, you know, people can be changed and influenced if they can take in a nuanced, deep portrayal of a fictional human being. It's interesting. Like, I think about Uncle Clifford specifically, right? I think about, you know, a lot of the queer characters in P-Valley, and oftentimes for our audience members, it's their first time in a relationship with someone like Uncle Clifford. Like, we've invited this person into their bedroom, into their living room on a Sunday night, and they're getting a kind of trial run with this fictional character, learning how hopefully to love and live beside an Uncle Clifford in real life. That's really powerful to be able to, through the power of story, teach people how to treat other people better, teach people how to be and coexist and have a relationship. Yeah. Even though it's a fictional relationship, right? But it's that first, sometimes people's first time connecting with a person like that. It's very powerful. And I, you know, we take it as a great responsibility, and it's actually a joy. It's an honor to be able to do that for certain communities and certain marginalized folks who have, you know, historically been so dehumanized.
I had an old news director who would always say, television isn't always right. And it isn't always wrong, but it's always powerful.
Oh my God, that's great. Yes, yes.
You know, it's always powerful. And, you know, I think about that because with your work, a lot of people would not be caught dead inside of a strip club. You know, they may watch it at home, but they wouldn't walk into one physically. But you bring them, you don't just take them there, but you artistically, and I think very tastefully, you show what happens, what goes on in the strip club. I love the shadowing, the technique, and all of that. It's tasteful, but at the same time, you meet these characters, Autumn Knight, Mercedes, Whisper Roulette. Everyone has a story, and you see, and you actually fold it in the pandemic as well, you know, but you relate because you want them to succeed, and you find yourself rooting for someone that you may not have ever connected with otherwise.
Yeah, it's it's the trick of you know, the accessibility of TV and the fact, you know, we've created all of these stadiums online who are gathering and rooting for these characters, watching them, wanting them to win. And real talk, sometimes wanting some people to fail. Patrice Woodbine, she, you know, everybody got to amp up since she stole Mercedes money in her gym. Both things, child. I don't know how that happened, but she's evil. But if you're like that, someone that you love to hate, learning about them allows you to understand why men and women do monstrous things sometimes. That's also a very human quality as well. So,
and that they're real people. Mm-hmm. You know, at the end of the day. Now, what would you say to someone who says just the very fact that this show exists and, you know, it opens up the conversation, allows you to feel, you know, empathy for certain people, that it condones the whole lifestyle? Because what I get from you is non-judgment.
Yes, agreed, right? I come from a place of, I'm not trying to glamorize this lifestyle. I'm trying to humanize it. And I think it has a lot to do with the fact that I do stand in a non-judgmental place. I do like to hold space for discomfort and conflict. And oftentimes, you know, you'll scroll through comments on Twitter or on Instagram where, you know, you have people who are saying that you're the devil, saying that you are giving Black women a bad name, and a part of you, because you know what you're truly, truly doing and you know what your intention is. You know that you're never going to please everyone, and that's not the purpose of art. But that you hope that people have an open enough heart to be able to stand in that space of conflict and questioning with you. And for those who can't, who are so, you know, quick to dismiss, you just have to allow them to be who they are, because real talk, that's just how the world is. Like, there are people who are always going to be dismissive of art that really challenges and tries to deepen what I think is, you know, some very tricky and taboo subjects. Particularly, you know, this season we're taking on all the lanes of sex work. We're, you know, not only looking at, you know, stripping, but we're also looking at prostitution, OnlyFans pages. You know, we're really, really trying to humanize all the women who participate in sex work. You know, we reveal that, you know, there's some men who have participated in sex work in the show, which I think, you know, is very important, so that we can just continue to destigmatize this work and these human beings who, for whatever reason, have to participate in this work to survive, or, you know, sometimes it's by force and sometimes it's by choice. And I think it's important for us to understand a world in which that is a way that a lot of people make their money, put food on the table, you know, pay for their college degrees. We live in a very patriarchal society. The reason why there is these exploitative spaces that, you know, they could be strip clubs, they could be brothels, all of it, you know, is because of this culture of consumption and culture of consuming women's bodies and Black female bodies specifically. And so in order for us to be able to tackle it and understand it, we have to show it. And so I never feel as though we're doing much condoning. I think we're doing more reflection, if anything else.
What has been your feedback from exotic dancers and people who work in these clubs?
That we did it, we got it right. You know, we even have former dancers working on the show. A lot of our doubles are former dancers. The women who play Jupiter, Peanut Butter, and a group of them, they danced in clubs before. And so we're constantly leaning on their expertise to, you know, like, let us know, are we doing this right? Are we doing this wrong? What's going on?
Right.
So we're just,
you went to the source, right?
Absolutely. Are always, always trying to hit the bullseye of authenticity. And so I actually think it's a claim to fame, you know, the fact that so many exotic dancers have really given us the stamp of approval.
Now, we all know that art imitates life. So how much of your art is imitating your life?
A lot. I would say that there's a lot of me in all these characters. I think that's the only way for them to feel real. You know, you just, you pull little bits of dreams and desires and fights that you've had, and you just place them in their mouths. And then my husband will be like, you said that to me the other day. I'm like, I sure did.
Wow. So I here's another quote of yours that I just love. Invisibility is racism's greatest tool. Invisibility. And there are so many who haven't had the opportunity to see themselves with nuance and love and complication. You don't have to be this perfect Black person to have a story about you. If you are a human being, you should be honored. I want you to see these women for who they are, and who they are is human. I think that says it all.
It really does. I just don't want little Uncle Clifford's and little little Murders and little Mercedes and Keyshawn's to not be able to see themselves. And this show, in its reflection, in its rawness, in its dedication to truth, it's a healing thing to be able to see yourself. And what I think is really beautiful about the show is that it often shows and provides playbooks to a different life, or to there's lessons. There's a lot of lessons in the show. And so I'm really proud that all these people that we're representing can get a lesson in self-love, because I do think that's the thing about being able to look in the mirror and see yourself. You begin to love yourself because you see it. You see your face, you see your skin, your dark skin, your skin with cellulite, all the imperfections, and allowing people to be okay with the imperfections, to be okay with their humanity. That, to me, is my job. And I will do it until the day that I die, for better or worse.
Representation, inclusivity, and the common thread of humanity, all cornerstones of Hall's work. I found Katori Hall to be delightful, funny, and inspiring. Thank you, Katori, for reminding us that we are all human. I think we forget that sometimes. Thank you, Wendell Pierce, and thank you for joining us. I'm LaTanya Norton.
Down in the valley where the girls get naked. If you throwing bands, then you know she gon' shake it. 1, 2, break 'em. 3, 4, rake 'em.